It's time for us to go ahead and get started. So just so you know, I'm supposed to be teaching Luke 7 today. And this is how far behind we are. So it's a good thing. But we'll just pick up where we are. We're at Luke chapter 5. We're going to be picking up in verse 27. And let's start with a word of prayer. Our Father in heaven, we're thankful for this day. We're thankful for the time to be here. We're thankful for this good church and the time to look into your word. Father, we're thankful for all that you give to us. We ask that you help us to be faithful to you, to grow, and to imitate your Son in every way. In your Son's precious name, amen. Well, I have two things to be thankful for, at least initially. One is this is a great church. When you go to little small churches, you see the struggles and just see how much talent we have here. So many people that could get up here and do a great job teaching, which I appreciate Jeremy filling in. We just realize we are blessed and we need to take that very, very seriously to go and to share with other people. The other thing is I'm glad to be teaching in English. Where I preached in Spanish last week, it's a lot easier for me to speak English, obviously. So, but I'm working on that. It's getting better and better. So, but I want us to just do a bit of review. I appreciate Jeremy stepping in for me while I was out. And I just want us to look at this story briefly about the paralytic as a means of review, because I think it highlights and summarizes a lot of what Luke is trying to say in Jesus about Jesus here. Because again, Luke is picturing the salvation of God. And one thing that is important is, while it is spiritual, it's not only spiritual. It's comprehensive or holistic is the way that we need to think about it. And this story highlights that. And he actually shows the priority. So when you look at the paralytic here, his friends are very adamant to get him to Jesus. He sees their faith. And what does Jesus do for him initially? Okay, he forgives his sins, right? And I'll tell you, I mean, if that was it, his day was made, right? I mean, he was set at that point. But what else does he do? Yeah, he heals him physically, right? And he has this statement here in verse 23, which is easier to say, your sins are forgiven, or to say, rise and walk. What's the answer? Which one's easier, though? Yeah, yeah. Right, right. Well, see, that's what's interesting. Okay, so I got to study some of this from a different perspective. The meetup study that they have, the community study, is on Mark. And we were studying Mark 2, which is Mark's account of this. It's interesting, he doesn't have this line in his account about which one is... the next line, where he says, but that you may know that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins. He doesn't have that line in there. And so initially, like when we were going through, I was thinking, hey, it's easier to say, take up your bed and walk, than it is to have forgiveness of sins. Because I was looking through it through the lens of Luke. But if you look at the lens of Mark, Mark says, hey, let me give you a sign, an example of that. But the whole point that we're trying to kind of get at with both of this is that it's not that God doesn't care about the physical. It's that God is more concerned about the spiritual. And that then needs to be taken care of first before the other is taken care of. And really, isn't that the concept of the gospel? I mean, when we have the forgiveness of sins and the resurrection we experience now, do we get our new resurrected bodies right now? But are we resurrected? Do we have new life right now? We do, right? And so you have the spiritual, and then you have this this eternal body that is given to us later. All right, so let's continue on here in verse 27, and let's look at verse 27 down through verse 32, verses 27 through 32. And I think this text is really just kind of a means of review. Remember, we're talking about the story, answering skeptics, and for the poor. And this story is really humorous to me because you have a doctor recording the story. So let's read 27 through 32.
After this, he went out and saw a tax collector named Levi, sitting at a tax booth. He said to
Okay, so this is going to be kind of a foreshadowing of a lot of what Jesus is going to be doing in the middle section. So I'm kind of setting you up a little bit, Kelly, when it, eventually, you know, in 3 months when we get to when you're supposed to teach. But what you have is, again, one of these times where Jesus is calling one of his disciples, very much like Peter. He leaves everything and follows him. But let's talk a little bit about the tax collector concept here. So who were the tax collectors again? Okay. So they were very looked down on in society because of that. But yet they were some of the most wealthy in society. And so he leaves all of that to become a disciple of Jesus. And then in verse 29, what does he do? Yeah, he has a feast, okay? And do I? Yeah, yeah. Come follow the person that's worth dropping everything for, right? So, again, this feast concept, I think maybe it's just highlighted more in Luke, it seems like in my mind, more than other places. But Jesus is going to have a lot of feast from this kind of point on, with either the Pharisees or with sinners. He's going to use that as a metaphor and illustration throughout it. So he goes through and he calls together a large company of tax collectors and other people. And what's the reaction of the Pharisees? Okay, so why are they complaining? What's going on behind it? What's the problem? Okay. Sure. Yeah. Right. Now, let's think about this for a second. Is it possible for good morals to be corrupted through evil companions? It is. But what's happening here? Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
So I think it's a question of if you are absolutely convinced that you're right in what you think, and somebody comes along and does something that you don't think is right, you're questioning whether or not they are who they say they are.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in this case, in the Pharisees' mind, there's no possible way this can be the Son of God, because if it was the Son of God, they would do exactly what we do, because we know that what we know is right.
Right. Yeah, and I think what we'll see as we go on is what they wanted is they wanted Jesus to kind of fill in the holes of what they wanted to be filled. And what Jesus is coming to do is not, he's not coming to fit into a box that you want him to fit into. You come fit in his box. You come and you submit everything to him. And we'll see that. I think that's kind of the point of the parable that we'll see a little bit later, is that he's not coming to just satisfy what the Pharisees are expecting. He's coming to fulfill the entirety of the Old Testament and undo the things that they need to change and be brought to. But one of the things that I think is important within this is that, you know, we stress from our kids to our kids 1 Corinthians 15:33, right? But what ends up happening is that the salt stays in the shaker the entire time, and it doesn't actually get out and change the world. I mean, I like salt on my meals just like you do, but I don't appreciate the salt just for sitting on the table and me looking at it. I appreciate the salt getting out of the shaker and impacting the world. And Jesus, you see that, here. He's going to the people that need him. He's going to the people in the world. And it's very easy as Christians to come here and say, hey, I'm being a good Christian because I'm in my holy huddle. Come here and I worship with Christians. I spend all my time with Christians. I go out and I hang out and I only have Christian friends. And what you see with Jesus is he's doing something very different than that. And he's hanging out with the people that we look at and say, why would you be with those kind of people? So what kind of people will we put into these kind of categories today that we look and if I was associating with them or if I caught you associating with them, we'd be like, why are you hanging out with that kind of person? Yeah, someone that believes in they're transgender. Yeah, the tattooed biker group. Go ahead. Yeah, the homeless. Yeah, struggling with addiction, whether that's pornography or whether that's drugs or alcohol. Yeah. Sure. If we really start peeling it away, guys, we start looking and saying, why are you spending your time with those people? Right? And it's easy to fall into this trap because we look at the Pharisees and we even look at the Israelites and we kind of laugh at them, don't we? We say, how could they do something so foolish? How could they just go through and criticize Jesus? And then we have our own blinders, don't we? Our own blinders that have to be removed by the gospel. Because here's the thing, even if we put different categories of people, how about different colors? You know, there's a time in this society that you didn't hang out with people of a different color, okay? The gospel transcends all of that. And if you have people saying, why are you hanging out with those kind of people? We just realize that's not the gospel, guys. And that's what's happening here with the Pharisees. And so it's very easy to react and criticize Christians that are doing this kind of thing. And yet, what was Jesus' response there in 31 and 32? Does he say, hey, look at me, I'm doing the exact same thing that they are. I'm going to go rob you like everybody else. He doesn't do that. What does he do? Go ahead. No, what else? What does he do? And the answer sometimes is just as simple as have that person in your house, right? Get to know them. Go ahead. That's at least it's initially what it's supposed to be. And sometimes you wonder if that was perception, right? At least these people knew that they needed it, right? So, but the idea is Jesus doesn't compromise his values. And if you're going to go into the situation and compromise your values, then please don't do that. But if you understand it's sin and you're going to try to help them, then please go. And so we have to be outside of that comfort zone of just being around the people that believe and think and act like I do. All right, go ahead. Sure. Yeah, I mean, it's the whole person that's struggling with addiction. You don't have them go back and hang out with all their buddies that are going to lead them back into addiction, right? But it is a person, though, that is conquered and is strong enough that can help them. So you have that that type of picture. Now, I think it's interesting, the next story is about this question on fasting. So let's read here verses 33 down through verse 39. Okay, so what are your initial observations? Any confusion on this one? Yeah, okay. Norma's over here. Tom's over here. I'm somewhere in between. So what stands out to you? What do you think he's trying to say? Go ahead.
Well, I think he's trying to say that I'm offering you something that's new.
Mm. Yeah, I think the line at the end that he goes through and says the old is good is kind of that's a bigger symptom of the whole issue. So I think we understand simply the whole point about the fasting, right? They're asking, why aren't you doing what everybody else is doing, right? But let's get to kind of the bigger section here. Go ahead. Sure.
It wasn't prophesied it would be a time of somber fasting and reflection, you know. And these illustrations about the, you know, putting the old cloth on new cloth and the wineskins are just things you don't do. There's three illustrations. You just don't fast at a wedding. You just don't sew a new piece of cloth on an old garment. And you just don't put new wine in old wineskins. It's just not what you do.
Sure. Yeah, and then you kind of have this kind of secondary meaning of this is inappropriate here, but it's inappropriate because you're misunderstanding what all is happening right here, is that Jesus isn't coming just to reform what the Pharisees want to reform. He's coming to fulfill the old law. He's coming to bring in his order. Go ahead. Yeah, so this is the time of the Messiah, right? This is kind of what we're talking about, is that they have been building to this point throughout the entire Old Testament story. Now he's here. You don't try to go back now. You want something that's new, the newness of the Messiah being here and what the newness, what that he's bringing. And so, again, the concepts that Jesus is bringing in is not necessarily that the old law is just dead and gone and all of that, but he is fulfilling it, and then he's bringing in his order. He's bringing it to completion, its purpose. And so through that, he's going to reform Israel. You got all these other themes that we've been laying out already. But when you go through and you see Jesus, you can't put him into, hey, just be like we've been doing things in the Old Testament. Just go through and be like the rest of us. He's bringing something new. There's an order that's coming in. Go ahead. Right. Yeah, I mean, there's good people that argue kind of both sides of this, whereas apparently there's some simplistic concept, but there's at least some type of play that he's trying to make of some difference that's happening. Go ahead. Right. Yeah. That's how I've understood it too. Go ahead. Yeah, I think what you'll see is initially they wanted to accept Jesus, but then it wasn't enough. He wasn't going to just fit into something that they had. There was going to have to be this holistic kind of change within them. And I think you'll see that right in the next story, is he's going to illustrate some of this. So let's keep moving. Let's talk about him being the Lord of the Sabbath here. So let's read both of these Sabbath accounts. We'll handle them kind of individually, but let's read here verses 1 down through verse 11. All right, so I think the explanation of the fasting is actually going to be seen in these next three sections, because the religious leaders are going to reject Jesus for various different reasons, And then what he's going to do is he's going to turn around and put in his new religious leaders. You see that? What follows after this is you've got the disciples going to be called the 12. They're the new leaders of the new Israel. And the Pharisees have shown themselves unwilling to accept him and what he's coming to offer. So let's talk about this a little bit with the Sabbath here. There's a little bit of controversy sometimes here on this first one. So somebody summarize for us here verses 1 through 5. What's happening? Have you ever done this before? Have you ever walked through a grain field? And so it's maybe some of us is a little lost. David, what are they doing?
They're walking through a grain field, a fifth field of wheat, and they are hungry, and they take off the head and throw it to the birds, and they leave it in their hands and blow the chaff while you eat grain.
Yeah.
And farmers do that all the time, just to test seed to Christ, and in this particular case, they're hungry. It wasn't harvesting, it wasn't working.
Sure. Okay. All right. So we've kind of got the first level of this discussed here. So what do they say about Jesus then?
Doing on the Sabbath what is unlawful to do.
Okay. What law are they referring to? Okay. All right. Okay. So there is a law, don't work on the Sabbath, right? Okay. What are they adding to, or what, like, give me more context. What's happening here? Okay. It was their interpretation of don't work on the Sabbath. Okay, go ahead. What are you going to say? So I guess we're probably going to have both the views brought up here. So some people think that he's going through and commending the action. I think he's actually saying they're hypocrites is what's happening. So what he's referring, the law that he's talking, that he is actually going through and observing is Leviticus 19, 9 and 10, Leviticus 23, 22, and also Deuteronomy 24, where they didn't go through and harvest the edges of their fields. And that was for the poor and the orphan and the stranger that was walking through there. And so if they were hungry and they didn't have anything, which is exactly Jesus' condition, they walked around, where are they going to get any food? It was specifically carved out in the law for people like that to go and to do that. Now you bring up the interesting side note, right? This is the other side of it. You couldn't even harvest manna on that day. But again, there's kind of a context of community and all of that. So I got all kind of comments. So go ahead. Norman, do you want to say something?
The law of manna was before the law.
Oh, you mean the law of he's the Lord of the Sabbath. He's the one that made the Sabbath in the very first place. Go ahead.
And I think to answer what Tom's saying, I think you almost, there are all these instances of what happens on the Sabbath. And if you watch the progression in the Gospels, it goes from this one to healing. There's a time, and I can't remember exactly where it is, but a woman who came in and who was bent over, and Jesus healed her on the Sabbath, and he will eventually, he'll ask the question in the next one, is it lawful to do good on the Sabbath?
It's later in Luke's account. He tells that story. And I think just within that, again, one of the reasons that I want us to see this, and we'll talk about it more in the sermon today, is that the Pharisees had lost the intent of the law. And the intent was to change their hearts. We think about the just, hey, rigid obedience. You just go back there, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. This is the first thing that he wants to have in their minds, and then love your neighbor as yourself. Yeah, the other stuff didn't matter. But that's the primary things. And then the other part of this is the Sabbath as well is directly tied to the character of God. It is about God giving rest to people and God bringing relief to people. That is really important. And that's the whole point that he's making back there in Luke 4 when he comes and he's talking about his mission of recovery of sight to the blind and setting liberty and all of those kind of things, is this is tied to God's character of what he wants to do, is to relieve the effects of sin. But when you go through and you have religious leaders that have twisted his law to make it now, instead of something that's about liberating and helping people, that now it's a tool of oppression on other people, there's an issue. And that's the kind of things that he's standing against. So let's comment now on verses 6 through 11. So in 6 through 11, you have a kind of another side of this same story, the same concept. And what do we have here?
He's healing on the Sabbath.
Yeah, so he heals on the Sabbath, which again, they interpret that as something that's not lawful. Maybe it's working, you know, but it's working within a certain concept because some of the other accounts bring that up with the priest. And this is what I want us to see, though. How do they react in verse 11? Yeah, why? Yeah. Sure, go ahead.
If a man sinned and they rebuked him, surely they wouldn't have that level of passion. They must feel personally challenged by the Lord in a way that is just over the top. It'd be filled with rage.
Yeah, I think it's in Mark's account when he tells this. This is when they plot to kill him. And so let's kind of dig into this a little bit. Why kill him? Over this, to kill somebody over this. Go ahead.
So I think you gotta almost put yourself in the place of the Pharisees. They are considered to be experts and the most knowledgeable in the law and to be the most holy of all people. Everyone, I mean, Peter even asked Jesus some questions like, if they can't be saved, who can?
Right. Right.
And I think the lesson for us is when I think I have something figured out and Jesus points out something to me, what do I do? Do I react with anger or do I change?
Right.
And I think, you know, that's the thing that we need to be careful of is that we think we have the answers, we think we have it figured out, and then when all of a sudden our misunderstanding or ridiculousness is pointed out,
Right. Yeah, and to me, one of the things that is so egregious about this, it's not like they had like misunderstood, I don't know, what murder is. What they had misunderstood is just a tradition. They had taken a tradition and put it on top of it. They had interpreted the law within their own unique framework. And when Jesus does something that is true to the intent of the law, it just like it broke their mind. It just was totally unacceptable that that could even fall within the categories of what the Messiah would do. And it was enough that that's what they wanted to kill him over. So it's just, and your point is definitely true. We just have to be very, very careful about the things that make us angry. Because when we get angry about something, we need to realize our idols are being threatened. And in this case, what do you think the idol is that's being threatened? Yeah. Yeah, the Talmud. Yeah, our body of traditions. We've already made this up. We've already decided what this was, right? The prestige, the pride that goes into that. I mean, nobody's ever choked on it, but it's hard to swallow your pride, isn't it? And that's what's happening here, is that they have been caught in something that Jesus is showing you've missed it, and you've missed God in the process. What else? What else do we want to say about the section? Go ahead. Yeah, it is interesting if you go through and you look a little bit later, Pilate comments on why they delivered up Jesus. Do you remember what the reason was? Envy. All it was envy, guys. We think envy is just kind of, oh, it's not that really, you know, it's not that big of a deal. And that's what got Jesus killed. And you go through and look, the concept was when the Romans come, they're going to take away our place. And we have to be very, very cautious about the types of things that that irritate us. Let's continue on. Let's read here verses 12 down through verse 19. 12 through 19. So now that the Pharisees have basically, across the board, disqualified themselves, now Jesus is going to go through and grab a ragtag bunch of people to be the leaders of his restoration. So let's read here verses 12 down through verse 19. Yeah, I don't know that there's any spot in the Gospels that highlight his expectation that they would, but it was their expectation that they would. Does that make sense? Go ahead. Even, I mean, Ezekiel, that's his whole big point, too, is that you have the religious leaders that think they've got it all figured out, and actually they're not going to be the ones. I may not be making myself clear. I may not be making it clear. So, okay, go ahead. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And so remember, we did all that echoes right at the beginning of this. Don't forget those stories. Remember Isaiah 40. Remember Malachi 3 and 4. Just keep those stories in your mind about what Jesus is coming to do. He said he looks at Israel as the booth that has fallen down, and he's going to restore it and put it back the way that it's supposed to be so that it will function. And he's going to be that faithful Israelite. So let's look here at 12, and let's read down through verse 19. In these days, he went out to the mountain to pray, and all night he continued in prayer to God. And when he came, and when day came, he called his disciples and chose from them 12, whom he named apostles: Simon, whom he named Peter, and Andrew his brother, and James, and John, and Philip, and Bartholomew, and Matthew, and Thomas, and James, the son of Alphaeus, and Simon, who was called the Zealot, and Judas, the son of James, and Judas Iscariot, who became a traitor. And he came down with them and stood on a level place with a great crowd of his disciples and a great multitude of people from all Judea and Jerusalem and the seacoast of Tyre and Sidon, who came to hear him and to be healed of all their diseases. And those who were troubled with unclean spirits were cured, and all the crowd sought to touch him, for power came out from him, and he healed them all. Okay, so we'll kind of keep the concept of the miracles just in our minds. Remember, this is just showing the power that Jesus has, as well as what the kingdom looks like, as well as his compassion on people. All of that kind of pictures are there. But let's talk some about the 12. You probably learned their names very early on, but I want us to look at the significance of what's happening here. So what stands out to you, or maybe should stand out to us as we look at this? Sure. Good. Thank you. So let's start with the kind of low-hanging fruit. Who's not in the group? Who's not in the in crowd? There's not a single Pharisee. There's not a scribe. There's not a Sadducee. And there's not a priest represented. And if you think sometimes the decisions we make are just as much about what we don't pick as what we do pick, guys. In this case, there's a huge message being sent by who is not in the group, who's not one of the apostles. Now, let's see who's in the group. Who are they that we know already from Luke 5? So God can use everybody, right? I mean, if you're a fisherman. Okay, so let's talk about that with the last couple minutes here. Who are the zealots? It's the first time they're mentioned within Luke's account, I believe. But who are they? Well, so the they really were. I thought I had heard Herod for some reason, but yes, they were the terrorists. So they were the people that go and, you know, there's tax collectors that are running along the road, and you hear about the tax collector's party being assassinated and the money being stolen. That's this group, guys. That's the people that sacked the Roman armies. You know, whenever he was afraid of, you know, hey, I'm transferring Paul out, and he gets all that army. That's the kind of things that they do, is they know this is the group of people that you go out in the foothills of Judah and you're a Roman soldier, a tax collector, you're dead. That's one of these people. Then he puts them in this category with one of those people that, given the right situation, he'd probably kill. Depending on where he was and all of that, how committed he was. And then you put him in there. So what do we see just in this concept? We see some really important elements, right? It's not the traditional religious leaders, but then we see a radical unity that transcends culture, economic status, relational status, all that kind of thing, that is weaved together to be the leadership at the very foundation that's going to be built on for God's people going forward. So, again, I don't want us to overlook this, but there's a lot here. And then 12, right? Let's not forget 12. What's 12 harken back to? Should be an echo. 12 tribes, okay? So 12 tribes of Israel. And so there's a reason he picks these numbers. So we have a new Israel being formed with a new leadership here. But Jesus is the leader, right? Jesus is the one that they're all going to follow. So he's going to be faithful. He's restoring Israel, and just like you mentioned, Malachi 3, the burning, purifying fire is coming in, and God is bringing in the outcast to be useful to him in bringing down those of pride and exaltation. So we're out of time. Go ahead. Oh, yeah. Right. Yep, that's, yeah, if you're making a big leadership decision, go and pray all night. It's a good thing. But again, that's Luke emphasizing prayer, but just showing this is a critical decision. So, all right, we'll stop right there. We're just plowing.